South, super safe seated. I couldn't. That's not the easiest thing to say in the world, is it? Bristol South, super safe seated Labour MP, that's Deputy Speaker too, Dawn Primorolo, has warned new Mayor George Ferguson against tinkering with the proposed bus rapid transit system. But is it the right way forward? Transport writer and former MEP for the region, Richard Cottrell, is about to bring out his book all about the railway axeman Dr. Beeching, 50 years after the Beeching Axe. He gives a perspective from outside the city, plus a disturbing issue of suicide mentioned just now as well. In particular, teenage suicide clusters in South Wales, Bridgend being the most well known. A Caerphilly man believes he's identified the cause, at least in part, suicide reduction initiatives that actually do the opposite. And if he's right, the most worrying side is it's being funded with our taxpayers' money, plus Martin Summers' weekly tour of the world's hotspots. So instead of the news this week, we've got you, and we've got a Vox Pop just all about the benefit cap. We mentioned it briefly there, but here are your thoughts. And over to our correspondent, Marina Morris.
Inflation is about 3%. The government wants to limit benefits rises to a maximum of 1%. Is it fair? And how will this help the economy?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously it's below inflation, so that's obviously going to impact families, going to impact single parents, going to impact everybody who works and contributes to the economy. And then it doesn't seem like we're getting a great deal more for our money. So I would say that it's definitely negative.
It depends who's claiming benefit and who isn't, for a start. If there's a genuine reason why somebody's claiming benefit and they've paid their stamp over the years, then maybe that's a bit unfair. But for people that are living on social and taking benefit on a regular basis without putting anything back into the economy, then maybe they could have made it zero and not 1%. Yeah, it's fair, because there's work out there for most people if they can find it.
I think you're right. I think it's going to be difficult. I think it's the balance between trying to incentivize people to get back to work, but at the same time support those who are really in need of benefits, and you know, they need to do that. So it's probably unfair from the point of view that the figure's quite off, 1% to 3%. Perhaps more fair, perhaps 1.5%, 2% might have been. Perhaps a bit more the other way, but I suppose from the economy side of things, difficult times at the moment, and there's a lot of people are having to take cuts, for instance, in salaries, or not had a salary increase for a number of years, so because you feel for the people who are really in need of benefits. And
no, I don't think it's fair, to be honest with you, because I believe that there's a lot of people out there who are working incredibly hard throughout this country, people who have come from another country, people who've worked here all their lives, like people who are just working to make a living. And I truly believe that I think benefits, when it comes down to either a maximum rise or a minimum rise, I think really at the end of the day, I think the system needs to be rethought, basically. I think it needs to start again. I think the fault lies with the government not changing it rather than the people who are on benefits.
How should the Chancellor George Osborne reduce the deficit?
You can't really carry on hammering the rich, because the rich are going to move elsewhere and the economy will suffer even more. So I think it's a very difficult question, but personally I think he's doing quite a good job already. I think it's reducing at a faster rate than what it was first expected. I think we ought to stick with it, really, stick with the plan as it is.
I suppose making more jobs available, but that's easier said than done. I think it's, I don't think it's very easy at all. It's not an easy job. It's a difficult climate these days. Competition is very strong from Eastern Europe, so I don't think there's a quick fix. I think it's just muddle on and see where it ends up.
I think they've tried to do as much as they can. I think where they need to do more is through young people, incentive to get back to work, more apprenticeships. I think they need to invest and get some of the infrastructure work going on, buildings, and to get building industry back on its feet, that they generate jobs, and get the banks to lend more money, keep lending, which is another problem. So it's a vicious circle, because job security is it's low at the moment. The economy is really flat, and it's not giving any people any rays of hope that things are getting better. I think once you start seeing investment go in, buildings, you feel a bit more secure as it generates jobs. And
first of all, like I said, you need to rethink the benefit system, but also I think on top of that, I think one of the biggest mistakes that they've made over the past 6 years is that they're not inputting enough money into getting the young people into work. You know, we've got things like the Prentice Trust, but that's really just for people who have probably come from the wrong side of life and haven't been able to make a go of things. More needs to be done for young people to get into good employment at an early age, and I think you need to invest in the young, and also invest in the people that have got something to give, you know, the elderly as well, because there's a lot of people in their 50s and their 60s who've still got a lot to give in terms of employment. It's a broad spectrum of problems, really, that the government need to really change.
Yeah, it's interesting hearing people talking there, because most people don't seem to understand that if you cut benefits, you're actually undercutting the economy. In Iceland, we were mentioning in the first hour, they've actually increased unemployment benefits. That's what you do in a recession.
Welcome back to the second part of BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Teenage suicide clusters in South Wales have puzzled parents and officials for half a decade, but a Caerphilly man thinks he may have some answers. Plus, Africa in the news this week, a new war in Mali and hundreds taken hostages at a BP Algerian gas plant right on the Libyan border. Also, Bristol South, super safe seated, I've said it again, Labour MP and Deputy Speaker Dawn Primorolo's warning a new mayor, George Ferguson, against tinkering with the proposed bus rapid transit system. But is it the right way forward? We talked to transport writer and former MEP for the region, Richard Cottrell. He's about to bring out his book all about the railway axeman Dr. Beeching, 50 years after the Beeching Axe. And as I said, the disturbing issue of suicide, in particular teenage suicide clusters in South Wales, Bridgend being the most well-known. Someone from Caerphilly believes he's identified the cause, at least in part, suicide reduction initiatives that actually do the opposite. And if he's right, the most worrying side is it's being funded with taxpayers' money. But we start this week with a look at the developing situation in Mali and in Algeria. And I'm joined on the line by writer and political researcher Dan Glazebrook. Hi, Dan. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, thank you.
Tell us, what's going on in Mali? Why now Mali? We've had many of the other countries up there, Egypt, obviously, Libya, the things going on. What exactly is the background to this intervention in Mali by the French mainly, trying to get the British and others involved too?
Yeah, well, the background depends how kind of wide you want to go. The recent background is, if you look at what happened in Libya since the execution of Gaddafi and the destruction of the Libyan state by NATO and its friends in the so-called rebel army, the insurrection, the insurgency, and the flow of weapons and fighters from there spread around the region, as it was widely predicted to, because Gaddafi was not just a master uniting the Libyan tribes, but actually in making deals and uniting the tribes across the whole region, as was actually outlined in an interesting article in The Independent today, I think, by Major General Jonathan Shaw, previous former head of UK Armed Forces. So it was widely predicted this would happen, and this has happened. And what the powers of France, Britain and US, the leading powers behind the destruction of Libya, were hoping was that flow of weapons and that instability would go on to undermine Algeria. The Western powers have had a long-standing problem with Algeria. Algeria, after the fall of Libya, now remains the last kind of resistant North African state, really, the last one that's built on the basis of the anti-colonial movement that kicked out the French in the 60s. You know, it's a genuinely independent state. It's not subordinated to Western interests. It is a powerful, strong state, and it conducts its affairs in its own interests, not in the interests of the Europeans or the Americans. Lest we forget, its oil and gas deposits are bigger than that of Libya itself. So they were hoping that the destabilization of Libya would actually go on to destabilize Algeria. But this hasn't happened. And in fact, the insurgency has spread to northern Mali. But Mali, of course, has a government that is already pro-Western since the coup that was launched last year. There was a coup last year that was led by a guy called Amadou Sanogo, who was spent 6 years in U.S. Officer training. So they already have this pro-Western regime in place in Mali. And so, of course, France, Britain, the U.S. are all thinking, well, you know, this is not what we intended, especially as the insurgents are now going south out of their base in northern Mali, going south towards the capital of Mali. And so France, the way I read it, France is attempting, and Britain supporting them very much so, France is attempting to bomb them back up towards Algeria, where they believe they belong. Basically, they want them to. They're not. This is not a war against these terrorists, so-called, as such, but actually to redirect their terrorism away from their allied state in Mali and towards the last remaining independent state in the region, which is Algeria. And it's interesting. There was an article in the Financial Times today, basically telling investors to pull out of Algeria. So it's clear that they're. This already, we can see that destabilization has indeed, it has had the intended result, has spread to Algeria, and FT is now calling on Western investors to pull out of Algerian oil and gas as a prelude, it seems, to economic strangulation of Algeria, perhaps then as a prelude ultimately to, who knows, perhaps even another NATO bombing campaign. And I think it's interesting how quickly the Algerian state reacted to this hostage crisis. If this hostage crisis had been allowed to carry on, it's very easy to see how France, Britain, the US could have used this as a pretext to get some, you know, kind of strong-arm the UN Security Council to authorizing some kind of intervention by them to free the hostages. So I think this is why the Algerian state acted so swiftly and decisively to try and get a hold on this hostage crisis before it could be used as a pretext for intervention.
Now, Dan, I mean, I'm surprised to hear you say that Algeria really is a truly independent state because I can remember back in, I think it was around about 2005, there was a lot of intervention from European countries, from the NATO countries in Algeria when they elected what was a very radical Islamic government. And it does seem that in many of these countries, like Algeria, like Afghanistan, actually that's what the people want. They want a radical, some sort of radical Islamic government. And yet that was stopped at the time by the French.
Well, I wouldn't say it was stopped by the French. The French certainly, at that point, were not keen on seeing this Islamic movement come into power. That's true, but it was the secular Algerian state that did the fight a very brutal civil war on both sides. I think something, several hundreds of thousands killed in this war. I think something in the region of 600,000, if I'm not mistaken. But it was the Algerian state that dealt with that. I mean, there was definitely brutality on all sides involved. But I think this is part of the reason why actually the so-called Arab Spring hasn't really spread to Algeria so far. What we've seen in other countries, especially in Libya and Syria, the pattern has been this kind of threefold, twofold in Syria, threefold in Libya, kind of pattern of middle-class kind of secular-minded protesters taken to the streets, and then these protests being used as a cover for kind of Saudi Qatari-funded militias to go in and then destabilize and launch armed conflict, and then that whole conflict being used as an excuse for NATO intervention, or in the case of Syria, for intervention, more subtle form of intervention through arming and training and equipping the rebels. Now, this hasn't happened in Algeria because the Algerians, I think, are wise to that, and from the experience of this brutal civil war that they had, they don't want to go through a trauma like that again. So they haven't, they've been very reluctant to launch any kind of movement that could be used as a pretext for either destabilization and civil war or even for open NATO bombing.
I mean, if we go back even further, Dan, to December 1991, the Front Islamique de Salut was a broad coalition of Islamic groups which dominated the first of two rounds of legislative elections, and those elections were then cancelled. It looked as if these radical Islamics were going to come to power in Algeria. But looking at the wider picture, what are BP doing in Algeria? They've come to an agreement with the government there, and it seems that somebody has decided that agreement to take gas from Algeria is not valid. I mean, are the people, these rebels, you think they're from Mali? Are they native Algerians? Because I was very suspicious when I saw that this base, which has been attacked with hundreds of hostages taken initially, is right next to the Libyan border.
Yeah. Well, I was reading a report from some of the hostages who've been freed that they felt they thought they recognised the accents as being Libyan and Syrian of some of the people involved. I mean, there are Algerian movements that are armed Islamic movements in Algeria, indigenous movements. But you're right, the proximity to the Libyan border is crucial, because that's where the latest flood of the best weapons is coming from in the wake of NATO's involvement there. So that is important. It's also important from the point of view that Algeria had just sent 35,000 soldiers to defend its borders with Mali, because it can clearly see what France is up to. It sees that it's trying to drive them north into Algeria, and it's trying to defend its borders to prevent that. But of course, in the process, that's obviously left its Libyan border more vulnerable. I mean, Algeria is a huge state, the largest state in Africa now, since the division of Sudan. So in defending its borders, the border with Mali alone is 2,000 kilometers. So clearly they prioritize defending the Mali border, leaving the Libyan border more open. But it's interesting, this hostage attack does seem to me to play into the hands of the Western agenda on many levels. I mean, the most obvious perhaps would be the kind of propaganda level. François Hollande promised this would be a very short war, and so on. This is obviously nonsense. So he needs to justify to his own people why a French soldier is being sent to kill and be killed in a war that will be a long, drawn-out affair. This kind of... So he's using this as propaganda. He's saying, look, this attack shows that evil people we're up against, and that's why we're there. On another level, it is destabilizing Algeria. Algeria hasn't sent forces into Mali. The rebel group who's done it claims that this is kind of taken in opposition to the attack on Mali. But it's strange that they would then attack Algeria, a country that hasn't got, one of the few countries bordering Mali that hasn't sent people to be involved in this war. So it is working to the agenda of destabilization of Algeria as well. And it's worth remembering that these rebel groups in Libya had established, you know, clear working links and coordination with Western intelligence and SAS and so on the ground in Libya. And I think we would be premature to think that all of that is ended now.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. I mean, it does seem that possibly we've created a bit of a monster by helping out the Libyan rebels, and that they are actually now giving their arms to various other people.
Well, that's what you might call the first level of the onion. But I think our other contributor was hinting at a further level of the onion, which is that these Islamist groups and the more extreme Islamist groups are in fact cooperating with Western intelligence and have got a track record of cooperating with Western intelligence.
Do you think they actually know that they're doing that, or is that, you know?
Well, I mean, I'd be interested in Dan's comments about this. But during the war in Algeria, which he said was extremely brutal and there's lots of brutality on all sides, there was fairly clear evidence that the armed Islamic group, which was carrying out most of the atrocities, was in fact being run as a counter gang by the Algerian army. And what I mean by that is they would go out massacring people claiming to be the rebels, wherein in fact they were being directed by the Algerian intelligence services, who were at that stage cooperating quite closely with the Western intelligence services. I think it's very hard for people who are not versed in all of this to understand that the intervention in the rebellions in Mali and all these other places create an enemy which you can then go in and hunt down, which means that you can then move geopolitically to keep out people you don't want running Africa, for example, the Chinese. Now, I'd be interested in Dan's comments on that, because I think he was hinting about that, and I'm not saying I've got any inside information about it, but we do know that this is the kind of game that NATO plays. They set up Islamist groups. They then say, "Ooh, look at these terrible Islamist groups. We're going to have to intervene here." And of course, it's a geopolitical game, to a game of risk, basically.
Okay, Dan Glazebrook, could you answer Martin's question there, and then also sum up with any other points you'd like to make?
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree that the extremist Salafist Wahhabist groups, a lot of them have been, they are funded by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, which anything that's done by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, these countries don't have an independent foreign policy, it will have been okayed by their Western masters and their British masters. Don't forget the Saudi royal family, the Qatari royal family, and the Bahraini royal family, incidentally, were all products of the British imperialism. The same families who were set up as proxies in power by the British state are still in power today. And the whole deal was, yeah, you can get fabulously rich on oil wealth, but you let us control your foreign policy, and that's still the deal to this day. obviously with more US involvement as well, but Britain is still very closely working with this guy. So all of these movements, these extremist movements, have all been funded by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, which means inadvertently they've been funded by the West. And as Martin said, yeah, they do serve a very clear function of destabilizing states that the West finds an irritant, like Gaddafi's Libya, Assad's Syria, and now Algeria. There's a wider dimension I want to talk about as well, of, and Martin mentioned this as well, about China, role of China in Africa. And I think the we need also to think of the perspective of the whole global economic crisis, and Europe's economic crisis in particular. And they're seeking to really, they've tried to enforce the kind of, force the crisis as far as possible to the extremities of Europe, to Ireland, Portugal, Spain, and so on. And now they're trying to really kind of incorporate, I think, North Africa. And there's a move by the EU to make a kind of NAFTA for North Africa, a kind of free trade agreement that would allow basically untrammeled exploitation of North Africa by Europe. And it's states like Algeria that have a basis in anti-colonialism, and states like Gaddafi's Libya that were at the forefront of resisting this. On an all-African kind of perspective, they're also at the forefront of resisting moves to co-opt the African Union. Gaddafi, and we've discussed this on your program before, Gaddafi famously was very, is at the forefront of moves to really push ahead with the African Union as a fully independent, economically independent regional body, fully integrated body. With him gone now, there's the U.S. military in particular have moved in very quickly with what's called AFRICOM, the U.S. African Command, as it's called. This year, Africa's been flooded with U.S. soldiers. There's 100 training programs in 35 countries to link African military structures within the kind of American, under an American chain of command via AFRICOM. This is the kind of project Gaddafi was opposing and standing the way of, which is now fully rolling ahead. And I think there may be an element of competition with the French, keen to get in, actually, as the U.S. expands its military influence. France is trying to do the same, because they realize the old mechanisms for the economic exploitation and extortion of Africa are more difficult now with the economic crisis in the West, and especially with the rise of China. China's able to offer deals that completely smash anything Western companies can offer in terms of mining deals and so on. So the West's increasingly being cut out economically, but the one area where it still does have a strategic advantage, of course, is military. So we're going to see a lot more, and we are seeing, and this is exactly what we're seeing now in Mali, much more military intervention in order to co-opt the African Union, to prevent it from becoming a fully integrated, independent regional force, and to try and keep out the Chinese. The West is falling back now, and its economy is in tatters. It's falling back on just pure, barefaced force to continue its extortion of Africa.
Okay, Dan Glazebrook, thanks very much. And now, where can we find you, follow you in print and online?
I've got a blog, which is called Rebel Griot. You can search for that.
Okay, you better spell that, actually.
Okay, Rebel, R-E-B-E-L, and Griot is G-R-I-O-T. If you Google that, you'll find that. But a lot of my videos and kind of interviews from Russia Today and things are on YouTube, if you put my name.
Or your favourite search engine, not necessarily Google.
Google will come up with some of the goods as well.
And what about Twitter? Are you on Twitter?
I'm not actually at the moment, no.
Okay, all right. Well, Dan, thanks very much for a fascinating insight into what's going on in Africa.
Okay, many thanks. All the best.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, transport writer and former MEP for the region, Richard Cottrell, is about to bring out his book all about the railway axemen, Dr. Beeching, 50 years after the Beeching Axe. But he gives a perspective now from outside the city, as he's in Italy now, on what's been going on with the bus rapid transit and other forms of public transport here in Bristol.
This is Richard Cottrell, formerly the Conservative UMP for Bristol here, now resident in Faraway, Italy, but still watching developments in the UK and indeed in Bristol with close attention. I shall shortly be posting a new book on Kindle at Amazon, which deals with the story of the infamous Dr. Richard Beeching and his war on the railways. the book is titled Doctor Who, Bomber Beeching and His War on the Railways. And among other things, it points out the fact that Beeching was in fact one of the early progenitors of the British atomic bomb. And I don't think this story has ever been told before, nor in fact that he had certain problems, mental problems, which made him unsuited not only to take on this task, but also to be a director of a large company like ICI. He was largely responsible for the destruction not only of a large part of the British railway network, but also ICI, which was one of the oldest British corporations, and died to death because of his and his fellow directors' lack of foresightedness. Well, having got that out of the way, let me come to a local topic, which is the Greater Bristol Metro. I watched this with fascination, and not without a good deal of horror. Some people listening to this now will remember that during my parliamentary career, I was also chairman of Advanced Transport for Avon, ATA, which projected a light rail system serving the city of Bristol. This was originally quite a successful concept. We succeeded in getting a bill through Parliament to convert the Portishead branch line, running down as far as Wapping Wharf and Bristol Temple Meads, through Parliament. It was the first private railway bill, standing still in my name, to pass both Houses of Parliament for nearly a century. And I can tell you that was some hell of an achievement. And the project collapsed because of the loss of the two city centre bills, numbers 2 and 3, which were vetoed by Dawn Primorolo shouting, "I see strangers," you know, this old call to stop legislation. And also by backwoodsmen in the Conservative Party, notably Sir Robert Wall, who was leader of the Bristol City Council for a brief period, and later for a long time, leader of the opposition to the Labour Group. He was never convinced of the virtue of this system. Primorolo was opposed to it because she apparently conceived the idea that I was going to use this as the launch pad to become MP for Bristol South. Well, I suppose this is about as likely as electing a Conservative MP for Antarctica, but never mind, I was never interested in that. I'm certainly watching this Greater Bristol project now, I suppose with a certain degree of schadenfreude, because whilst I think it's worthy, I think it should happen, I'm afraid it isn't necessarily going to work. It's based totally on the existing metals of the British Rail network, whereas our system, back in those ATA heady days, was in fact basically a train tram system, which is now all the vogue everywhere all over the world. In other words, you ran trams on existing railway tracks, and when the railway tracks ran out, you ran tramway systems, as have now been developed all over the UK. Fantastically successful systems in Birmingham, in Manchester, in Croydon, and in Sheffield. And this is what we had in mind. We called it the Bristol Super Tram. So whilst I wish this well, I also wonder why it is that Bristol is always the place where great ideas come to die. And lots of projects which involve aviation have gone wrong there. Lots of projects which involve railways have gone wrong there. And I think a very foresighted scheme to provide Bristol with an urban transit network fit for the 21st century was needlessly destroyed by people who were covetous of their own positions, or simply out of envy, and simply out of misunderstanding or not understanding what it was all about. Bristol has the biggest and highest level of second car ownership, I think he says right, anywhere in the UK. And I haven't been there for a couple of years, but the last time I was there, the traffic chaos was absolutely phenomenal. You look at this and you see tram systems sprouting up all over the world now. In almost every city over 100,000 population wants one or has got one. And Bristol, which was one of the first to promote the idea of a public-private partnership to construct the system, still has got nothing.
We had, during the war, whilst the Blitz was going on, Richard, we had a tram system in the city.
Yep.
And that was actually quite a good system, wasn't it?
Yes, it was one of the best in the UK. What happened was, the Bristol Omnibus Company wanted the trams out of the way. And ordinarily, that would have been done in a peaceable fashion. But in fact, what did happen, of course, was that the Brislington depot opposite the old HGV studios was hit by a very high power bomb, which wiped out quite a lot of the tram fleet. And this was used as the excuse to shut the system down almost immediately. If there is to be any hope for sensible public transport in the city, then some of the things that the greater Bristol Metro people want to do are eminently correct. This is reopening the Portishead branch line, attending to the revival of the Severn Beach branch line, which is carrying phenomenal increase in traffic. I was looking at this on Wikipedia quite recently. I'm completely astonished that that line has really taken off. It was one that was going to be closed by Beeching, by the way, just as Portishead was closed by Beeching, but Severn Beach, serving what was famously known as the last resort, is still there. It's right to reopen the Henbury loop because there's going to be a lot of development in the old BAC airfield region. But it's still not enough. It doesn't attend to reviving, as we wanted to do, the old Midland Railway line, which ran through Wormley and Downend to Bath. This was very much central to our proposals. And nor does it take people to the city centre. I think this is really where the project, in the end, will come unstuck. Well, it won't come unstuck because they will do something. But it will not be as impressive and dramatic as other light rail projects in the UK. It will not answer the needs of curing traffic congestion. It will not answer the needs of reducing excessive carbon output from traffic jams, cars, lorries, whatever you will. This is where it fails. It's a disappointment, I must say. And I rather felt that sooner or later someone would come along and say, let's pick up the old ATA idea. Evidently not.
The solution to congestion being touted at the moment is a London-like congestion charge, which the Mayor has said he's going to implement.
Yes. You know, this is part of Big Brother society, don't you? This has got something to do with actually congestion charging. The last time I was in London, which wasn't very long ago, the congestion is completely unchanged. In other words, there's lots of it. So there are lots of people that pay the congestion charge. But the congestion charge system works very simply on little spies attached to every piece of street furniture that you can possibly imagine, which spot the number plate of the vehicle and report that to a central base. So this enables all those drivers to be recorded the moment they set onto the road and where they go on their journeys, where they complete them, how long they stop here, there and everywhere. It's all part of a system, in fact, to subject the United Kingdom to a kind of Big Brother state. It's an interesting statistic. The UK has 1% of the world's population, but it has 28% of the world's CCTV cameras. This is almost never stated, but it should be stated more and more often. So every time you hear something about a congestion charge, you should wonder, you know, what is this all about? Is it just to cure congestion, because it doesn't do that, or is it to find out where everybody is?
Richard Cottrell there, speaking to me earlier this week. And his book, I believe, is going to be called Bomber Beeching, The Destroyer of the Railways. And it's coming out on Kindle any time now. So it's Richard Cottrell, Cottrell.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, the disturbing issue of suicide now, and in particular teenage suicide clusters in South Wales. Bridgend is the most well-known. A Caerphilly man I'm about to speak to believes he's identified the cause, at least in part, the suicide reduction initiatives that actually do the opposite.
My name is Timothy Rogers. I'm from Rudry, South Wales.
And you've been looking at a lot of activities going on within your, particularly in your local community. Many people know that there's been some mysterious clusters of teenage suicides in South Wales. Have your investigations into what's been going on in your community come up with any possible answers?
Absolute concrete answers. The only thing that we haven't concluded is, were the children subjected to the material? encouraging suicide. There's networks operating that's pushing out very damaging material to children. If I can just tell you about a few psychological studies, one is the Werther effect, which is contagion suicide. It's Werther because this was the first incident of contagion suicide in Europe.
Is that W-E-R-T-H-E-R?
Yes, that's right. Now, young Werther wrote a book about his life, a biography. He was a very famous novelist called The Joys of Sorrows. Throughout that book, he wrote about his terrible ordeal as a homosexual, the way he was treated, the joys and sorrows of his life. And at the end of it, the way he couldn't see any way out, so he killed himself. When that book was published, it's been published four times in Europe. Every single time there's been a huge incidence of cluster suicides. Now, when I started researching this information, as I was just studying what was going on in my community, and it led me to Bridgend, and then I was coming across an unbelievable amount of material that's being pushed out to children through the creative arts and drama theatre networks. What I saw of it was this organisation called Common Purpose, but they're colluding with organisations, theatre networks, and this is all funded by a man called George Soros. He calls himself a philanthropist, but he's trying to establish a population reduction. And apparently they want to reduce the population to 500 million from 7 billion or to a billion.
A lot of it has been giving money to help the poor.
They're not helping the poor, they're actually targeting the poor and deprived communities. And this is what I've also identified. Let me just tell you about another study of suicide, so you know, we're all on the right track, we understand what I'm talking about. Now, I've been looking at images specifically of children with scribbled out faces and children with ropes around their neck hanging in theatre productions. Now, there's something called Schneider's Failings, or it'd make more sense to you if I said Schneider's Findings. And basically, it's a consolidation of world reports and theories, and professors of sociology have consolidated and refined the reasons, the primers, the mechanical primers for suicide. And three of them are thwarted love, lost belongingness, and assaulted self-image. Now, these are the images particularly that were put out at my community centre, Rudry Parish Hall, South Wales. It was an assaulted self-image of a child. He was standing in front of a traditional church, and it appeared that the spire was a KKK hat. You looked at his face, it was scribbled out. You looked a little bit further down, he had a chalk or a blade in his hand, so you'd automatically presume that he'd scribbled out his own face. You look further down the picture and he'd wet himself. So we've got an image that absolutely fits the Schneider's Failings, which is suicide mechanical primers, on that image for the play for Rudry Parish Hall.
Did that play actually take place then?
It did, and several others. And there was another one with a child that was slumped in a chair. He had a green jumper on, which is identical to the local primary school, which is 500 yards away. He was slumped in a chair with blood coming out of his mouth, with his head down on an angle. It was two adults either side of him looking at him, and he had a reef above his head. And then above that, it was the Babylonian god Moloch, the child sacrifice god. I'm sure I don't have to expand what that play was all about. They then had the Wicker Man. The Wicker Man was a sacrifice symbol to the Babylonian god again, Moloch.
Well, hang on, Wicker Man was a film, wasn't it?
Well, it was, but there's a theory behind it. The Wicker Man was used to put lots of children in his belly, and it was children, specific children, to the Babylonian sacrifice god Moloch.
Everyone would agree it's very disturbing having these kind of plays going on in a small village community or anywhere, really.
Right,
but
right.
I mean, your task in a way is to actually tie that to those clusters.
Well, no, I didn't tie them to the clusters. The material tied them to that area. One of the plays down there, I watched it, and if you read the book, The Joys of Sorrows by Werther, it was a remake of that book. So they would know that book was the first study on suicide contagion. And the National Theatre of Wales put out the identical production in a theatre for children to watch.
I think there's also a feeling, Tim, that a lot of the modern art is not very good. I mean, we, for example, here in Bristol, we had a Temple Quays when that was built, just near Temple Mead Station, a whole new office complex and a pub called the Knights Templar. There was a giant beetle, black thing, about as big as three or four people, that was put out in front of it. And the office workers, after about 8 months, I think, within the year of the place opening, decided that they didn't want the beetle there. I mean, it didn't seem like the sort of thing they wanted to sit next to at lunchtime, a giant beetle.
Well, what I'm looking at, I repetitively was coming across the same theme. Suicide, self-harming pictures, ropes around children's necks. Some of the directors of the theatre productions on their Twitter was talking about specific material in relation to suicide. I was coming across images and plays. Suicide, 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 constantly. I mean, if anybody looked at that in isolation, they'd think to themselves, oh my God, this is awful. When you start putting it together and you're seeing a similar theme, the identical theme almost, in so many theatre productions, you've got to think to yourself, what is going on? So I've studied these phenomena, not just in Bridgend, by the way, but there's also clusters happening around the Aborigines in Australia. They've got children in communities hanging themselves. Los Angeles, 28 children over a period of a few months threw themselves in front of trains. We're having that in Bridgend as well, mind, but this is no longer going in the mainstream media. And I'll tell you about that. There's specific guidelines for the media not to put this material out. Not just glorifying, just reporting on it. Because if you report, this can actually encourage the Werther effect, the suicide clusters. So if you just bear that in mind, that is documented, you can find that anywhere on the internet, it's not really complicated, and then you think to yourself, well, if the media reporting it can cause suicides, what if the theatre is ramming her out close and personal to vulnerable young children? And I tell you something, it's very hard to draw some empathy to this, being an adult. I mean, I'm 43 years of age. But I tell you what I can relate to is when I was 8 or 9, I watched a film called The Hand. I snuck downstairs. My mother and father told me not to, and they went to bed. My older brothers and sisters were up. And I watched this film, The Hand. I look at it now, and it's ridiculous. But this gave me nightmares over a period of 6 months.
Are you talking about the old black and white?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, hang on, just to correct you, because the actual title of that film is Peter Lorre's, the star of it.
Yeah.
The actual title is The Beast with Five Fingers. I can remember it was particularly brilliant acting by Peter Lorre.
Yeah.
This hand is sort of self-propelling itself by squeezing its fingers and moving it on its own around the house.
Yeah.
And you go around the corner, you can hear the piano playing downstairs, very spooky. And they go around the corner and there's a dismembered hand actually playing the piano.
Yeah.
Very creepy film. And actually quite expensive to buy. I had a look at it a few months ago, funnily enough, yeah, online.
Yeah, well, that's right. But that, I mean, a silly film like that now was, as adults, as grown adults, it's like really water off a duck's back. Let me give you another example, and I'm just trying to...
I mean, you watched it as a child, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you shouldn't have done that, but you did, no. And you say you had nightmares.
Nightmares for months and months after. I wouldn't sleep in my own bed. I snuck in my brother's bed late at night because I was petrified this hand was going to get me.
So there are very good reasons why these films are not allowed to be shown to young children.
Absolutely. And let me give you another example. I mean, children are vulnerable, and they should be treated that way until they're grown adults. And we used to have Mary Whitehouse, didn't we? I mean, she was wonderful. At the time, I used to think to myself, God, what's she on about? But once you start to get into this and understand the psychology behind it, you can see why people like this should be watching everything that's going on in theatre, and even in schools, because we've identified this material in schools as well. Let me just give you another example. My daughter, she's now 19, she's in university, but when she was 9 or 10, my wife's nieces came down and babysat. We went out for the evening. Everything was okay. Come back. The children were in bed. The following morning, my daughter got up and she said, Daddy, she said, I can't stop thinking about death. And I said, what's the matter, babe? She said, I just keep on thinking about death and terrible things. She said, I can't get it out of my mind, she said. And I said, well, why is that? She said, I think it was to do with a film I watched yesterday called Jeepers Creepers. I went, oh my God, I said, what was you doing watching that? I didn't know what that film was particularly about at the time, but it was clearly a horror film. And then my wife told me then, she's phoned her niece and said, oh my God, you shouldn't have showed her that. It's really upset her. And she was like this for a couple of weeks after. She said to me, Daddy, she said, I can't get death out of my mind.
No, our children need protecting, don't they?
Absolutely.
I mean, even teenagers, anything up to sort of 18, 21, I mean, 16 maybe, but I mean, they really do need protection from these images and from these horrible ideas.
Now, I had a counsellor phone me 2 weeks ago called Liz Alsworth. She's a lovely woman, and she said, Tim, I've watched your video with Brian Gerrish. I'm very concerned, she said, because two children in Grygracker Estate tried to hang themselves a few weeks ago. And we've been informed there was a website called No Balls, and I thought, aye. So I said, okay, I said, which community centre or youth club do they go to? She said, well, I'm not 100% sure, she said. I said, well, I'll tell you what, let me have a little bit of research and I'll get back to you. So I put the phone down, I went straight on the internet and looked at the people who were running a couple of community centres around Grygracker and Bedworth and Pufflepant. I soon come across a lady's name. I put in the search engine, Caerphilly, it came up with Twitter, and the first video on her Twitter was the most appalling, awful, disgusting encouragement of suicide play I've ever seen in my life. It was a young lady about 18, 19 years of age. She had a fairy cake. She was at a party. It was laced with prescription tablets, and she was licking them and smiling on the screen, and then she was individually picking the tablets out of the cake and putting lots of them in her mouth. It was also flashing images come up on the screen saying kill and all sorts of other terrible things. So I phoned the councillor back. I told her what I discovered. I said, have a look online now. I said, well, I'm on the phone to you. She was going, oh my God, she said, what's going on? I've just made an inquiry. This woman is running a youth club in Bedworth. Now, it is my strong belief that a group with a different ideology to ours, they're not Christian, they're not Muslim, they're not Catholic, they've got a very twisted, sick ideology, and I think this group is deliberately trying to get close to children, and I think the agenda is depopulation. That's ultimately what I think is going on. So what I would like to say to any mother or father is be very, very careful about what sort of material your children are being exposed to, particularly creative arts and drama from youth clubs and community centres.
Now, with the wonders of the internet, a lot of the youngsters will be looking at some of this material on their phones.
That's correct. But that's something that you can monitor to a certain age. But that is not the problem. The problem is direct, up close and personal, awful films and theatre and arts being put out to children. I tell you what else we've come across as well, is that several times now we've come across reports that's been in the mainstream media that some teachers have been given suicide lessons to children, euthanasia. And what they're asking children to do is write their own suicide notes. Now, that's happened several times over the last 18 months.
Can you give me any specific examples?
Yes. In Hawthorne High School, it was mentioned in the Welsh Assembly, it was in the mainstream media, and she asked the children to write how they would kill themselves. Now, we saw this happening in Scotland, in Cornwall, and in Ireland. Now, the suicide rate have gone up in Northern Ireland, 568% in 1 year. This was immediately after they put out the suicide prevention strategies. Now, this sounds an enormous figure, but let me just tell you exactly how it is. From 1999 to 2005, there was an average of 32 suicides of children in a particular category. I think it was 14 to 24. They brought out the suicide prevention strategies in the middle of 2005. The suicides skyrocketed to 137. You're talking about suicides, cluster suicides in geographically small locations. Now, if it can be argued to say, well, hang on a sec, our suicide prevention strategies didn't come out the following year it went up by another 37%. Now, this happened identically in South Wales. Now, I might have a year wrong either way, okay, but the details and the literature is absolute fact. Now, we had suicide prevention strategies set up in Bridgend in May 2005 or May 2006, and then the following January, whichever year it was, the following January, we had the suicide clusters starting in Bridgend. It is my belief that these suicide prevention strategies are not really being set up to help suicides, but to actually precipitate them. I don't say that loosely. I've looked at the material and it's absolutely disturbing, and the figures of suicides are consistent with these organisations being set up, where they're being set up, soon after suicide clusters are starting.
So what would you, as a parent, say to other parents who are worried about the kind of material their youngsters may be exposed to, even under the guise of, hey, this is there to stop suicide?
Be there for your children, and remember Schneidner's failings, thwarted love, they broke up with a relationship, assaulted self-image, lost belongingness, fractured control is another one. You know, you don't have to ram it down your children's throats, because what will happen then is you'll put it into their minds. And after the information that I've studied, I was petrified to speak to my children about suicide. But I did actually a few weeks ago, and I was very, very careful about it. And I can assure you I would never, ever ask them again. But I've always struck a very fine balance with my children. If they do something wrong, I won't overly react, because if you do, your children are unlikely to come to you and say, Dad, Mum, I got this problem. So there's got to be a real careful balance there.
Yeah, it's very difficult, isn't it, for parents with teenagers nowadays. Teenagers can be very free and easy, go their own way, and often the family love and respect can break down sometimes between teenagers and their parents. So obviously that creates a difficult barrier to cross.
It does. And I'll tell you something else as well. I'm not a homophobe, far from it. But I do know that one of the triggers for a suicide is for children to be confused about their sexuality, particularly when they're going through puberty, 14, 15, 16 years of age. And this can also be a factor, and as I said, about whether he was a homosexual itself. So what I would advise parents, I'm not a perfect parent, we all just try our best, but what I would say to parents is just be there for your children and listen to their needs. If they're getting bullied, and don't overreact, so we're there to be able to speak to them, and so they can trust us to come to us with all their problems. And I think that's it. It's been suggested that depression is the factor for suicide, and I just don't buy that. I just don't buy that at all. And I don't care what anybody says, I've read the studies on it. It's a very difficult time for children when they're coming up to their exams, and a very vulnerable time indeed for them, from when they're about 11 till they're 16, 17. So just be there for them as parents.
The other thing, of course, is that we keep hearing about assisted suicide, don't we, in the news? Well, this is something which is supposed to be good. I mean, I must admit, I find it very difficult to get my head around why a doctor would become a doctor to help someone to kill themselves. The other thing, of course, is if someone who's ill decides they do want to end their lives, then that may be just a momentary thing. They may sign the piece of paper, they don't get a chance to reverse the decision, and then of course there's also the possibility of papers for assisted suicide being signed fraudulently.
Well, I'm absolutely glad you brought the subject up, Tony, because I've also followed this side of it. I don't know if most people would be aware of it, but they've got death vans in Holland picking up the disabled, the elderly, and putting them to death without the consent of their family or themselves or the doctor. We're having this drive run straight away through the West again. George Soros single-handedly made the move, being the Rothschilds frontman. He made the move for euthanasia. Watch the telly, it's all over there. They're trying to show sad stories where people were desperate to end their lives. And they're propagating us. What I would say is switch that telly off, on, get onto the free media and listen to stations, you know, like 93.2 FM, and start to find out what's really going on in our society, because the only way it can get is worse. They're pushing out pathways. Tony mentioned what the doctors are doing last year. You can find this all over the... this was advertised in the mainstream press.
That's right, the Liverpool Care Pathway. The Daily Mail has gone very big on that, saying that essentially, even though it's called a care pathway, it actually means that life support is being taken away from patients.
Well, it's not just life support is being taken away from them. They're actually withdrawing in the most cruel way food and water from these patients. My mother was a nurse for 40 years. I've been brought up in an environment that we want to care for people. My mother cared for people all her lives. But now we've got doctors introducing them onto what's called pathways. And these elderly people are dying from starvation and dehydration. 130 patients last year they put to death this way. They're also now doing it with babies.
Okay, so what's the larger agenda? What's the wider agenda, Tim?
Right, the wider agenda is destabilisation. depopulation and to bring on a one world government. It's all going on right under our noses, and unless people speak out, it's going to go full circle. We're looking at a similar system being built in our country to the Bolshevik system in Russia, and all these forms of government, it's not even communist, it's a dictatorship to bring on this state order. All of these governments end up in genocide. In Russia, we hear about the Jewish Holocaust, which is awful, and with 6 million innocent people lost their lives. But over in Russia, under the Bolshevik murderers, they murdered 60 to 110 million ethnic Russians. I spoke earlier about the civil contingency plan, and they're going to organise a clampdown on society. It's going to be in the next 18 months, 2 years, I believe. They're going to bring on a full dictatorship. This is what we're looking forward towards. So I'd advise people to start researching, you know, and get involved with groups so we can stop this.
Tim Rogers there from Caerphilly with some pretty frightening information. Whether it's true or not is difficult to know, but certainly very, very worrying that these suicide triggers are actually appearing in plays for young children, when we know that that sort of thing is being kept off of films and TV because it can actually trigger suicide. Anyway, do contact the programme if you want to know more about that, and I'll put some links up to some good sources for people who are worried about that particular topic of suicide on the website, which is www.thisweek.org.uk after the show.
Drive Time on BC FM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now I'm joined by, on a much, much lighter note, Eddie James and Kieran Doswell. Hi, guys. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi.
Now, first of all, you, Eddie, you've got an event on in the city centre tomorrow, haven't you? At the Art Bar at 27 Broad Street.
Yes, and it's www.art.artcommunity.net. There's more information on
the web, yes, but how do you actually walk down there when you haven't, you're not on the internet, you're not on your phone, you're not one of these people that walks along watching their smartphone and bumps into things because you're so busy on the internet? So you're on Broad Street tomorrow between 3 and 9. You're very opening your doors. Why are you doing that?
Well, basically, we are a collective. We do believe we can make a difference in Bristol. And we've invited anybody that has a good idea to make this a better city, more sustainable, more equal ops, and really wants to have fun doing it as well. So we really are there for them. This is a building that is owned for 100 years. It's for the people, run by the people.
So the people can't own it, surely. That means the council, doesn't it?
No, it's a long lease for 100 years.
Who are the actual owners? Is it you?
I'm the owner of the building, but it's a building that is going to stay in the public domain. It's not going to be sold or kind of broken up or disposed of. So it's there as long as it takes.
Fantastic. Well, so you're actually inviting people to come down in the city centre tomorrow between 3 and 9 on Broad Street, the Art Bar, to contribute towards the life of the building in the future.
Absolutely.
And what's your vision for it then?
Well, my vision would be for the building to operate on the multifunctional level, from music to sustainable food, any idea that can make this a better city, any projects that want to be run from here. Communication is a vital factor, so we're linked up to all the major media, you know, faculties like Facebook, Twitter. It's easy access without going through all that problem of hiring and worrying about a venue. So this is a venue that works at most levels.
Now, you keep an eye on a lot of the arts that goes on in the city centre, don't you? I remember last time you were in here, Eddie, you were talking about one of the big street party events that you were questioning whether the council actually bothered to get a drinks licence for it. What was the upshot of that?
We're still waiting, obviously.
Still waiting for a reply from Bristol City Council?
Because basically, it's not that we objected to the art in the city. It's a wonderful thing. What we objected to was the council spending that amount of money and not sponsoring the St Paul's Carnival, which is a truly international event. Whereas the street
some
party,
very mysterious decisions coming out of the city council at the moment. I must admit, this thing to do with the Sainsbury's, which looks as if it could even close half the shops on Gloucester Road, is also a bit of a mysterious one. Also, Kieran, what's going to be your contribution tomorrow?
Well, my contribution is to kind of bring in some some organisational kind of aspects, and to provide advice on kind of how to set up projects. I kind of have some experience in that with the Trinity Centre.
Yeah, what about arts centres? What can you do, do you think, to actually get arts into... I mean, it's not all about money, is it?
No, it's about people. Everything's about people, and kind of anyone who thinks otherwise is deluding themselves, really. People make things happen, and they just need to be able to communicate with each other. So it's about creating a platform, creating a space that they can share ideas and share their creativity.
I mean, we've got that the bar, which has got an upside down cross on Corn Street, which I always think, look, go past there and I call cross to the other side of the road. They look a bit creepy, but this is a very different view you've got for the city centre, Eddie. Can you just remind us where and when it's all happening between 3 and 9 tomorrow?
Yes, it's the centre of town. It's in the old part of the city. It's bang near the, Hortz is the pub, and it's very, very accessible. So most buses take you almost past the door.
Okay, so that's between 3 and 9. At 27 Broad Street, the Art Bar tomorrow. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good, happy week. And our website is www.thisweek.org.uk. The web page there, you can find the links to all sorts of items online, if you're online, to various items on our programme. So see you all next week.
Sky News Centre. BCFM News on the hour. Bristol has been gripped by snow today with over 4 inches.